I'm going to talk a little bit about conversion in context, and here it's a friend of mine. Well, he's not actually a friend of mine, but he's one of the D people, and this is taken, I think, around the 1950s on a D plane in northern Cameroon. He's a Goik, he's a religious specialist. And these religious specialists played a crucial role, you know, in the conversion process. And Chris talked about ritual versus belief, etc. And these are very important things also in an African setting. During this presentation, I will take you on a short journey to a more recent historical period. And I will give you a small glimpse of my own research regarding the encounter between Norwegian missionaries and representatives of the D people in northern Cameroon between approximately 1934 and 1960. And first I will say a few words about the modern mission movement. Then I will give you a short presentation of the case I have studied. And this will be followed by a few words about theories of conversion. Before I will try to sum up my lecture through some lessons learned, followed by a question mark, of course. But I will start by setting the stage and talk a little bit about the modern mission movement as a global venture. The modern mission movement is, of course, a relative term, depending on how we wish to apply it. In a Norwegian setting, it is very easy to locate the start since the first Misjonsforening saw the light of day in 1835, actually in the small village of Farsund, where I myself grew up. And these small associations, they grew in numbers, and in 1842, the Norwegian Missionary Society was founded in Stavanger, and in 1843, the School of Mission and Theology received its first students, and in 1844, the first Norwegian missionary, Hans Per Schröder, sailed to South Africa. It could be mentioned here that School of Mission and Theology, where I actually teach today, is the third oldest higher educational institution in Norway, after the military academy and the university in Oslo. School of Mission and Theology was actually the third school. We are a very young nation, and it also says something about the importance of the mission movement in Norway as a folk and a social movement. The Norwegian mission movement was particularly influenced by the mission movements in Germany and in Britain, who from the 1790s onwards sent missionaries to places that most people never had heard of. And this Northern European network of ideas and practices turned into a global network during the famous Edinburgh Mission Conference in 1910, where the mission movement from all five continents for the first time gathered in order to discuss a strategy for future mission work. One of the ideas from the conference, which was later put to life with much success, was the so-called Apostle Belt Strategy in Africa. The Edinburgh meeting concluded that one of the great challenges for mission work in Africa was the Muslims who were on the move further south through the Saharan desert. And as a response to the Muslim activity, the conference decided that they would encourage the different missions to establish a belt of mission stations from Senegal in the west to Kenya in east, across the whole continent. One Norwegian response to the Edinburgh call for action was the founding of a new organization called the Sudan Mission, which in collaboration with the Norwegian Missionary Society decided to establish a mission in northern Cameroon, a region with no previously established mission and a large Muslim population. Why this somewhat long introduction to my case study from Cameroon? Well, I am getting more and more convinced that a fruitful analytical approach towards studies of the spread of Christianity, both as a religious and as a social movement, is to study it as a global venture. The term globalization itself is very much contested, and critics claim that a word that can be used to describe close to any social action ends up being unable to describe anything at all. But when it comes to the term globalization, I could not agree less. But in order to apply the term with sense, we have to be very specific about how we apply such a theoretical approach. In the case of the modern mission movement, it is easy and it's necessary to connect the spread of religious ideas to the technological developments which follow the Industrial Revolution. The colonial period was fueled by many different desires, but they were all connected to the idea that the globe suddenly had become accessible. It had become possible to look for commodities on continents far away, and it had become possible to extend political and religious influence upon yet new groups of people. But more interesting for us in this colloquium might be more interesting than technological revolutions is the way the sociologist Roland Robertson defines globalization as a movement towards a global consciousness. This does not mean that globalization necessarily moves people in the exact same direction in terms of rationality or worldview. My recent studies of global Pentecostal networks point in the opposite direction. But globalization theories can help us understand how important common ideas, which affect people's beliefs, faiths, and attitudes, are spread across the globe. The most common approach within global studies is to study how neoliberal capitalism and computer technology changes economic and social interaction in a radical way. But if we aim at conceptualizing Robertson's idea, I would say that what happens through mass mediation of Pentecostal crusades, through YouTube and DVDs, might be compared to what happened when Paul traveled around the Roman provinces as a tent maker. Important human networks were created and spread, and central ideas about life, morality, and death made people change the way they reflected upon their ultimate concerns, the way they conducted their lives. And in this sense, even conversion in the Middle Ages might be analyzed from different angles based on the analytical approach and on the point of theoretical departure. Then I will move on to say something more about conversion in context, about the Dee people and the Norwegian missionaries. Well, it was a fairly long introduction to this journey which aims at getting to know the Dee people and the consequences of their meeting with the Norwegian missionaries. Well, the Norwegians, they first started to work among another group called the Mbom people, but they were too influenced by Islam, and it was not until the missionaries encountered the Dee people during an evangelization tour in 1934 that the missionaries gained a foothold among the local population. And the initial research question for my first study of the Dee people was a rather simple one. Why did a large part of the Dee population become Christians? And as with all historical projects, I soon encountered the inevitable challenge of sources. Despite excellent mission archives in Stavanger, where all the missionary reports, all the mission publications, together with a good deal of personal correspondence are to be found, I still knew very little about the Dee themselves and why they welcomed the missionaries. Not one single report or note was to be found from the first Dee Christians. And the imbalance in the sources stared back at me from the archives like a big black hole. But what I soon found out, though, was that several of the Dee pioneer Christians from this period were still alive. And unlike you medieval historians, I could actually travel to Cameroon and interview them. But how to do this? My growing interest in the social sciences was of great help in this period. And insights from the field of historical anthropology helped me find methodological and theoretical tools, which again helped me approach the searches, the sources with new insight. Well, to interview people about what happened 40 to 50 years ago and then compare it with sources which are written while history was, so to speak, in the making, it was not an easy task. But insights from discourse analysis helped me organize my sources, and in the following, we shall take a brief look at some of my findings. First, a few words about the Norwegian missionaries. The Norwegian sources, when I was going to analyze them, I was inspired by the anthropologist Goffman, who divides things into different groups. And all the published articles in the missionary newspaper, Missionstidene, Missionary Tidings, I label them as front stage publications. Whereas the reports from the missionary meetings and the private letters were treated as backstage publications. Why did I do this? Well, the first group of publications had a particular aim. In addition to informing the friends of the mission in Norway about the failures and successes of the work, it clearly aimed at encouraging the readers in Norway to continue to donate money and to continue to pray for the work in Cameroon. This genre of publication followed a well-established pattern within the mission, and it also cemented a particular theology of mission which described conversion to Christianity along predefined lines, influenced by contemporary theological and cultural thinking. So one example of this is something that Johannes Trana wrote in 1941. And he wrote, "One might ask, but when they become Christians, what is the nature of their conversion? What do they turn away from? Here we have to be careful. If one thinks thoroughly through this question, one will conclude that their conversion is much more radical than it is for us in an old Christian country. We have hundreds of years of Christian life and Christian culture behind us. Compare this with a thick, dark wall of heathendom that has existed for thousands of years. Like a labyrinth is his life. Spiritual forces, most of them evil, surround him. When he wakes or sleeps, cultivates, builds, he's constantly surrounded by spirits that he has to consider. If not, he will be harmed. Immorality, quarrels, fighting, and untruthfulness is he fed with from infancy. But love, helpfulness, empathy, and compassion are unknown words." Well, we easily forget that when we receive the faith, we could take the whole Bible into our hands and through it receive knowledge about the road to salvation and the Christian life. How many Africans can do the same? Well, conversion here, it's first of all a theological concept, but close reading and analysis of the missionaries' texts also underscores the strong historical and cultural currents connected to the discourse. This is a theological mission, but it is also a civilizing mission, aiming at spreading a particular social and cultural practice connected to a particular Western colonial mindset. Then, what about the Dee peoples? Even more interesting than how the missionaries describe the encounter is to analyze the Dee self-presentation of why they chose to accept the message proclaimed by the Norwegian missionaries. And I must admit that I was rather surprised by the direction that the interviews with my first informants took. Well, I will tell you the story about one of the very first encounters I had with an old lady. We sat down in her compound on the logs, and after the initial greetings, talking about the fields and the children and so on, I got close to my research and I asked her, "Well, why did you actually become a Christian?" And she said, "Well, you know, Flutum had a truck." And I said, "What?" And I thought she had misunderstood my question, so we talked about other things. And well, even if she mentioned this mysterious Mr. Flutum several times, I just put it aside as a sidetrack. But then I was doing my second interview further north. And I was, after the initial talking about other things, I also talked to this second informant, "Well, why did you become a Christian?" And he said, "Well, you know, Flutum had a truck." And I realized that it has to be something here that I have to dig into. And then what followed was very interesting, because then he told me a story from his youth. He said he was around 15 years. He was among the young people who had to carry the tax of this particular village up to Ngaoundere, quite far away, where the Muslim leaders and the French colonial administration had a headquarters. And he said that he had to carry this sorghum, which is what they cultivated, on his head. And it took him 5 days to walk up to Ngaoundere and to give them this tax. And then it took him 3 days to go back, because then he had no load and it was downhill. But then he said, "But then came Mr. Flutum." He took his truck and he went from village to village and he put the tax in the truck and he drove all the way to Ngaoundere. This is why the Dee became Christians. This is how we were liberated. And I said to myself, what a brilliant missionary strategy, you know. How can I find out more about this? And I ran back to my sources and tried to look in the missionary publications if they wrote about this strategy of mission. Didn't find anything. And I went to the reports from the conferences. I didn't find one word about it, not even in the private letters. And I said to myself, what is this? And later on, even my young research assistant, who was in his 20s, said, "Well,
even he had heard a lot about this Mr. Flutum from his uncles and so on. So around the fire at night, people were talking about this mysterious Mr. Flutum who helped them. And he actually only stayed 2 years on the D-plane. And what he basically did was to construct a Bible school. And then he went on to live elsewhere. So he didn't even spend a lot of time with the D-people. And of course, my interpretation after having found nothing in the sources is obvious. You know, he went down to the D-plane to construct. He went with a lorry full of construction material. When he was going back, it was empty. And of course, if the D-people wanted him to carry something, of course he could do that. And that's a very interesting to see how people interpret these things kind of differently. And we will come back to that. But I would say that the missionaries' so-called unintended participation in what was to become a political struggle, actually, it also became evident through the success of the missionary schools. The missionary front stage publication could inform the readers in Norway that a lot of D children enter the schools in order to learn and to read the Bible. And one informant put it this way. I was Muslim as my father, and we used to pray together until the arrival of the Word of God. Everybody went to listen. Since I did not want to be isolated, I decided to go and listen myself. I went there all the time with my friends. Later, I asked to be enrolled, and the catechist accepted me and taught us the word of God. And my father told me, "My son, since you have become a Christian, you have to leave this house." And I went to live with the catechist. I discovered that my life, it was a new life, because if I had stayed Muslim, I would not have learned anything. I would have prayed without understanding anything, since everything was in Arab. When I became a Christian, I learned to read the Bible in French and in Bum, and that is what I followed. It has to be mentioned here that the Muslims in this area, they refused to teach these other groups Arab, because they wanted to keep kind of Islam something of a secret for themselves. It's always a part of you know, the slavery trade and everything else. But the point was here that Christianity made literacy accessible in comparison to the other forces in the region. So on one hand, the arrival of the missionaries opened up new possibilities for a young generation of Deem, whom the Muslim Fulbe refused to teach Arabic and whom the elders refused to influence the Deem traditional ways. They realized that the missionaries represented a path towards the strange change which most of my informants labeled modern. But the content of this journey along a new path was understood quite differently among the two groups. And one informant put it this way. Well, initially the D would not send their children to school. But when they understood the importance of the French school, a lot of families decided to send their children anyway. When the sous-préfet or some authority or wrote a letter to a village chief, he could go to the catechist in the next village. Then the chief had to pay the other chief in order to borrow his catechist to read him the letter. And this created a rivalry, a competition. If he saw that everyone asked for a catechist in order not to have to pay a lot for the lecture of his letter, it was this competition between the chiefs. No, no, it's my catechist, it's not yours, it's mine. You had to pay a chicken or sorghum or money in order to borrow a catechist to read a letter. And this attitude was materialized before one of the missionary teachers, who one morning found the school building empty. The D pupils had actually gone on strike. They refused to come back before the missionaries also started teaching French in the D schools. So far they had only been teaching in Boom. So the missionaries' civilizing mission was not civilizing enough for the D. And the missionaries wrote in the 1936 annual report that it is with great sorrow that we accept French to be the language in our schools. The missionary dream was to teach the vernacular languages in order for the gospel to touch the heart of the Gentiles. But the D wanted hard currency in order to negotiate a better future with prior obsessors. And I'm sure that Pernella can say much more about literacy and importance of reading and writing afterwards. But then, let's move on. Is it possible to create solid theoretical models in order to grasp what religious conversion is all about? Well, many scholars have indeed tried, and some have made more lasting footprints in the academic debate than others. If we go back, we might look at Peter Berger, who has seduced many readers with his grand narrative about the sacred canopy. His attempt to show how a religious worldview represents a certain plausibility structure, a socially constructed and socially maintained fence against chaos. To keep a religious community living is, according to Berger, a process of continuous reconstruction and maintenance of the particular world in question. Interruption of these processes might threaten the world, and therefore each world requires a social base in order to exist as a world that is real to its adherents. Religious conversion is, though, still possible, but would be understood as a response to a crisis large enough to threaten the structure of the worldview and thus move the individual towards a new plausibility structure. I have myself tried to coin Berger's thinking with Thomas Kuhn's focus on paradigm change within scientific history. And I've asked myself whether it is possible to compare Kuhn's focus on anomaly within science paradigms, it means something that does not make change sense, with emerging crisis within religious communities, which sometimes leads to conversion. And for many researchers on conversion, crisis is always a key word. Even, you know, modern church growth research focus on the fact that when people are moving, they are more open to reorienting their lives and so on. And also James Rambo has used this in his well-known Matrix. But let's move on to African studies. Bengt Sinclair, he attempts to formulate contextual conversion as a mathematical equation. It might be more amusing than illuminating, but it carries with it a strong desire to understand change, and let us have a look at this. Well, this is what conversion looks like to Bengt Sinclair. So now you medieval historians, you should go back and read some math before you continue your work. But interestingly enough, what is he doing? He says that, what is conversion about? It's about mobility, first of all. And there you have to put into brackets, to be a refugee, to return, migration, and so on. You have to add the importance of tradition, and it's very much about kings and slavery in many African settings. And then you have to add the mission, the Catholic or the Protestant mission, and then you have to divide everything on the influence of colonialism, whether it's strong or it's weak and so on, and the result, you have the Ecclesia Africana. So this is the way we should go about. It's kind of funny, but it's also, it shows that he's very keen on putting conversion into context. You have to see all the contextual factors which will influence this. And also the plus minus in front of colonization is important because there's a lot of different conversion stories from the colonial period. Well, the fact that the mission movement is so closely connected with the colonial period in time complicates the process of trying to distill religious conversion from the social surroundings, a sin that was committed by many missiologists during the heydays of the movement. Secular scholars' counterattacks on the missiologist writing of history have been numerous. And Robin Houghton, as Chris mentioned yesterday, among others, has argued that the success of Christianity in Africa was due only to an inevitable mass movement towards modernity. Mass movement that would have occurred with or without the arrival of the two world religions, Islam and Christianity. But again, as Chris mentioned yesterday, the most discussed contribution to the current debate about conversion in Africa has by far been the writing of the anthropologist couple Jean and John Pomeroy. Their approach towards the British missionaries among the Tswana in southern Africa is very fascinating reading and shows that also anthropologists know how to spend time in the archives. Some of their conclusions have, however, been strongly debated, and John Peel and Terence Ranger have been among the more severe critics, claiming that the Komarov's writings leaves us with a picture of the Tswana as a people without agenda, unable to resist the modernist tide represented by the missionaries. And personally, I also find the Komarov's focus on colonization of consciousness somewhat problematic, especially because their strong focus on imitation of missionary practice undermines the strong ability to use missionary teaching and technology for alternative purposes, which is so obvious in my own studies from Cameroon. Well, in an attempt to theorize my own findings from the demission encounter, I identified four different terms which might illustrate the conversion process. And the four terms are as follows. First of all, it is about crisis. There was a crisis in the collective identity, and the traditional practices had not been able to produce a fence strong enough to protect them from Muslim and French political and economic dominance. So this troubled the D people very much in this period. The second finding was about attitude. Several of the informants said that the missionaries came with tenderness. They didn't even beat us, one person said. And that was when they were put in difference with the French and the Muslims. Among three different paths towards modernity, the Muslim Fulbert, the French secular, and the Norwegian Protestant, the D chose the ally with the most sympathetic attitude, who took an interest in the situation and who considered the D, at least to a certain extent, as equals. And of course, not all groups accepted Christianity, so there must be something that was important to the D. My third point is about translatability. These newcomers had a message that was translatable into the D context. It had a focus, first of all, on vernacular languages, and it had a space, intended or not, that in the long run was able to make an adjustment between the missionary message and the North, in its North European Lutheran wrapping, and what Andrew Walls has called the African map of the universe. Finally, of course, we cannot get around the context. I would say most of all, important of all, is that this conversion took place within a specific historical and political context, which to a large extent influenced the development of the encounter. And then, finally, are there any lessons to be learned here? In an attempt to sum up these very brief glimpses of the D-mission encounter, I will try to look at that. First of all, I would say that conversion always has to be analyzed within the frame of that encloses the largest picture. Conversion is always contextual. The arrival of the Norwegian evangelist was a tiny event in a global mission movement, and what happened with the D people happened with several other ethnic groups in Africa in the same period of time. The D people were clearly attracted by what they call modern. And I think that there are at least two ways to approach the major changes which radically changed the African continent during the colonial period. First of all, there was an obvious and negative push factor inherent in the colonial project. Colonialism is by definition connected to a power and to the ability to force people to make choices against their will. A side of the African conversion coin described in detail by the Komarovs. There is, however, also a pull side of that coin, which we could describe as the move towards what Robertson labeled a global consciousness. This common consciousness is, of course, and at best, partial and very vague. But there is evidence in my material that it was a strong attraction towards the images and ideas transmitted by the missionaries, also among the D youths who were not in daily contact with the Norwegian strangers. And I think that these two forces, which moved society towards change in its specific historical context, have to be considered and evaluated in order for us to understand the larger picture. For too long, I think that colonialism has only been on the negative side when we analyze change in Africa. And in order to understand what's going on, we have to see that there are several forces working at the same time. Secondly, I would say that the history about Fløttum's truck is interesting because it gives us a lecture in semiotic analysis. It shows that the converter and the converted interpret the same events and signs very differently. What to Fløttum most probably was a most natural reaction to help some of the D by transporting the harvest in an empty truck, it has become a myth of political resistance and religious liberation, which is alive even among the young D generation today. The oppressed in general interpret the actions of the oppressors very differently from the people in power, and this insight is important when we search for motivations behind conversion. Finally, I would mention that the action of the colonizer or the proselyter always create a reaction among the colonized or the convert, but these reactions are unpredictable. The D people went on strike because they wanted to learn French in schools of the mission, thereby turning the tools of the missionaries to other use than intended by the Norwegians. This is an example of how meaning is negotiated between converts and converted. The French language was hard currency in the fight for political independence because it made the D able to communicate directly with the colonial administration. And with the help from the Norwegian missionaries, the D-plane actually was turned into a canton, which is the smallest administrative unit within the French administrative system, and thereby removed from the political area dominated by the Muslims, and the D were thus freed from the double taxes they had to pay. To sum up, conversion is, from my point of view, always contextual, but it is at the same time very often connected to consequences of global change. It is more often than not preceded by some kind of crisis, and the message has to be translatable in a wide sense, but it can happen with or without a truck.